Florida has no real fossil fuels to help power our lives. Instead, we burn energy from elsewhere. Over 6 years, demand for natural gas to generate electricity in our state has jumped by almost 50%. I'm Tom Hudson. Coming up on the Sunshine Economy, powering paradise, energy in South Florida. More and more of the electricity we rely on to cool our homes and light our businesses comes from natural gas. We're second in the nation in burning it to make electricity. We're also thirsty for gasoline. We're one of the top states for demand of that fuel. Could our car culture in South Florida ever adapt to electric vehicles? It's all ahead on the Sunshine Economy, powering paradise, energy in South Florida, and it's next on WLRN. This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, burn all Roxanne!
This is the sound of change in South Florida, the sound of switching how electricity is made in our region. This was the demolition Saturday morning of a 60-year-old Florida Power and Light power plant in Palmetto Bay. Two 150-foot-tall smokestacks slowly falling back to earth, two boilers with their steel exoskeletons crumbling along with them. This was the second FPL power plant to fall in as many months. Back in July, the half-century-old FPL Port Everglades plant was brought down. At least four FPL plants that used oil to generate electricity have been demolished in recent years. In their places, nuclear power plants and turbines burning more and more natural gas. Now, since 2007, demand for natural gas by Florida's electric utilities has jumped by 50%. 12% of the gas burned to generate electricity throughout the entire nation is burned right here in the Sunshine State, making us the number two state in the nation to use natural gas to make power. Florida Power and Light is leading this charge. We spoke with FPL President Eric Szilagyi on the Sunshine Economy about this move toward natural gas and the utility's nuclear plans.
Well, you know, Tom, actually, FPL started about a decade ago, weaning ourselves off of imported oil and shifting to domestic-made natural gas. We have, over the last basically 10, 11 years, gone from the utility in the country burning the most oil to burning almost no oil. I think with this year, we're at about 65,000 barrels of oil burned compared to 41 million barrels in 2001. That's a 99% reduction in oil. And of course, at today's oil prices at $104, $5 a barrel, that's a lot of savings for our customers. So it's a good way to save the customers a lot of money. And it's also a great way to help the environment. And then also importantly, Tom, for all of us, I think, as Americans, it's very important to wean ourselves off of that imported oil and not ship that money overseas to places that aren't as friendly to Americans as we'd like.
Yeah, there's a real economic interest here on price. There's a real environmental interest and a real diplomatic interest as well. But what drove this transition that this industry here in the Southeast has really undergone, especially over the past several years? You've seen a significant push by FPL and others, again, toward natural gas. Is this driven by the supply of natural gas and the price versus the supply and the price of crude oil?
Clearly, the prolific amounts of natural gas that have been discovered utilizing the shale play fracking, that drilling using fracking technology in places like northern Texas and Oklahoma and Louisiana, even all the way up into Pennsylvania, that has made a big difference because it has expanded the supplies that are available in America for well over 100 years are the current predictions. And frankly, I think that's conservative given where technology is taking us. The price difference also makes a large difference in how you think about this. You know, we've saved our customers in the last decade by switching off of oil to natural gas $5.5 billion because we also put in fuel-efficient technology. So it's a combination of a lot of things. You know, we installed new technology that's a lot more fuel-efficient. It produces the same amount of power, sipping a lot less fuel. That saved our customers $5.5 billion. And by making that switch, we moved to natural gas, which is also good for the environment.
When you talk about saving consumers $5.5 billion, is that a savings in how much higher prices would have been if FPL was still burning that crude oil lot from Venezuela to generate electricity?
No, actually, that $5.5 billion is a calculation of how much fuel we have not burned. And then multiplying that by the price at the time that we would have bought it.
So it's getting more power from natural gas, being able to burn that more efficiently compared to crude oil.
Right. The equivalent is like taking that 1960s Cadillac, which many of us think is beautiful in many respects, but not the most fuel-efficient machine, and putting that one in the museum and instead pulling out a nice fuel-efficient hybrid. And that's what we're doing with our power plants. We've torn down, just like we did at Port Everglades just a few weeks ago, a plant that served us well for half a century, but frankly wasn't the most fuel-efficient machine that we had. And so we tore it down. We're building a brand new $1.2 billion plant that's 35% more fuel-efficient. That means we'll produce the same amount of electricity, burning 35% less fuel. We're also then taking that fuel and switching from oil to natural gas, domestically produced, a lot cheaper than oil. Of course, that could change. Oil can always come down. But, you know, what we've seen also is the political difficulties that are always seem to come out of the Middle East and also other places like Venezuela make oil, I think, a very difficult fuel to count on. And I'd much rather rely on America when it comes down to our fuel supplies, which our customers' needs.
Eric, let's talk about the portfolio mix for the kinds of fuels that FPL relies on to generate electricity. A majority of that is natural gas today, isn't it?
A majority is natural gas. Like I said, for the last decade now, we've been switching from oil to natural gas. Of course, we still have a large component of our portfolio that's nuclear power, and we just finished two very large uprates, or those are expansions, of our existing nuclear plant, Turkey Point, and then also our one in St. Lucie, where we're now producing an extra 522 megawatts of power out of those two plants. And that's helped on the fuel diversity for us as well. Very important part of our portfolio mix.
I got to ask you about Turkey Point because, as you know, there's been some consternation about the further expansion there over the next decade and expectations, and FPL unable to kind of promise when the next expansion is going to come despite collecting the dollars from consumers to help pay for it.
It's very important for consumers to understand that we're not collecting any money in advance. What we've done is we are paying for the license application that's required by the state as well as the federal government in order to have the option to build a plant at Turkey Point. What customers have paid for are two uprates that are completed and operating and saving customers hundreds of millions of dollars in fuel savings and, of course, producing more power now and producing zero emissions.
How much has it cost so far, and is that cost being borne by customers or by FPL?
Well, Tom, the costs are very expensive because the requirements are extraordinarily in-depth. We've spent about $211 million just filling out all of the necessary applications to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the state, going through the hearings, providing the engineering studies. That's money that we actually went out of pocket, and then we go to the commission every year and ask permission to actually recover that after we've spent that money from customers. So, you know, this is a process that we do every single year, and I'm proud of the company for doing exactly what we said we were going to do, and that is to only have the customers pay for what we deliver. The uprates, as an example, are done. They're operating. I'm very pleased with that. The bill on the customers in 2012 was $2.20 a month. We just went to the commission and asked that to be reduced. We're going down now to an estimated bill of 46 cents a month. So we've paid for those things. The customers have paid for those, and we're reducing the bill.
And the critics will point out, though, you're asking customers to pay for a licensing procedure that may or may not end with a license to build a nuclear reactor.
Well, you know, our goal, and I disagree, because what we're doing is everything we can to get the license issued by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. I mean, obviously, I can't guarantee with 100% certainty anything in this world, and the federal government, I can't guarantee exactly what they're going to do. But I know that we have met every single requirement that they have put on us. The team has done a tremendous job to do that. And what's very important for customers to know is that we're not asking for, nor does the law allow for us to charge customers in advance for the construction of the project. You know, the moment that we're out there turning dirt, we have to go out and borrow money like everybody else to build the plant. And customers don't pay for that until the plant comes online.
Any projection on when that license may be forthcoming if FPL continues to pursue it at Turkey Point?
You know, we're still waiting to hear from the federal government as to when that will take place. We filed all the paperwork several years ago. We've answered a multitude of questions. Of course, we also have local permits that have to be obtained, and Miami-Dade area as well, and that has been delayed. All of these delays, you know, add to the time, and ultimately they also add to the expense. We would love to be able to move the process crisply forward, but many people do have questions. Many people do want to delay just for the sake of delay, and of course, you know, that ends up dragging the process down.
What percentage of the overall energy fuel comes from natural gas versus nuclear?
We're about 65, 68%, I think, natural gas. We're just a little bit short of 20% on nuclear at this point.
And the rest filled up with a little bit of petroleum and the rest renewable energy?
We have renewable energy, and we also buy some electricity when it's available in the market, if it's cheaper to buy than it is to produce. So it's a mix of different things, including, of course, the 110 megawatts of solar that we built here in Florida that I'd like to do more of.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that investment. Is that beginning to pay off?
Absolutely. It's every day the sun comes up, we're able to take our foot off the gas at the Martin Solar Hybrid Energy Center. The plant out at DeSoto, which you recall, Tom, when we opened that plant, that was the nation's largest solar PV facility, is doing very well. And the one up at NASA is producing power every single day. So any time that we can use the sun to produce the electricity, that helps our customers. It makes sense. It's not a silver bullet, Tom. You know, it's a technology that works great during the day and not so well at night, as you know.
Well, for obvious reasons, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it's something that I think makes sense for us to do more of. Prices are coming down and technology has actually gotten even better. We're building solar facilities. Our sister company, NextEra Energy Resources, are building massive solar facilities in other parts of the country. So we have a tremendous amount of expertise here. I'd like to do more, but it's got to be part of a portfolio, part of a smart mix, just like our financial portfolios, right? You and I's 401k hopefully is well diversified. That's the way I want our energy mix to be.
That's Eric Szilagyi, president of FPL here on the Sunshine Economy. He told us that FPL can meet its customers' power demands for the next 5 or 6 years with its current fleet of power plants, which speaks to the future demand for power. Join the conversation at WLRN.org on Twitter. Use the handle at WLRN and the hashtag Sunshine Economy. Still to come on the program, a proposed natural gas pipeline running through 16 counties here in the Sunshine State.
Obviously, to build a large infrastructure project like this is going to take many years, many jobs. It's going to be a huge impact on Florida's economy.
This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN, the conversation on Twitter at WLRN. Use the hashtag Sunshine Economy. We're talking about powering paradise, the energy industry here in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Hundreds of miles of proposed pipeline may begin pumping natural gas between Southwest Alabama and Martin County, Florida, within 4 years. Now, this is natural gas destined to be used to generate electricity for Florida. But first, FPL needs to get the okay from state regulators. WLRN Miami Herald reporter Gina Jordan explains how the project might impact Florida's economy and the environment.
This is a two-part project. The Northern Pipeline will stretch roughly 465 miles from Alabama to a hub in Central Florida. From there, a second line will run 126 miles to a Florida Power and Light plant in Martin County. The natural gas that's piped in will be used by consumers around the state. Mike Soule is a vice president for FPL and former secretary of the Florida Department of Environmental Protection.
This project has a Central Florida hub that interconnects the existing pipeline system in Florida, the Florida Gas Transmission Pipeline and the Gulfstream Pipeline, so that we also significantly improve the reliability of the pipeline infrastructure in Florida.
The existing pipeline capacity is almost full, so FPL solicited proposals from companies to construct the pipelines. Two companies were chosen, and they'll spend an estimated $3.6 billion to do the work. Seoul says FPL won't pay construction costs, but it will pay rent, essentially buying the right to move gas along the lines.
We hope and expect to begin construction in 2016 and complete that construction and begin actually using the pipeline in 2017. We expect to see some 8,600 direct and indirect jobs associated with construction of this pipeline.
A tentative route for each line has been established. The pipes will be buried a few feet underground, and Seoul says they won't pass through much land owned by the state. The company is contacting property owners that might be impacted.
Whether it's a transmission line, whether it's a road, when you look at Florida's geology and geography, you need to identify those corridors that already have some linear features to them, like adjacent to roads or other transmission corridors. And that helps reduce the concerns and impacts to businesses and residents.
FPL has to go through a lot of permitting at the federal, state, and local level. This process actually started several years ago when the company offered up a very different proposal. The Florida Public Service Commission rejected it and told FPL to come up with something more cost-effective. That led to the current proposal. Tom Ballinger is director of engineering for the commission. He can't comment on whether this new proposal will be approved, but he can talk about the potential impact.
It's a very highly regulated industry on the safety and the construction aspects of it. Obviously, to build a large infrastructure project like this is going to take many years, many jobs. It's going to be a huge impact on Florida's economy. We are the second largest consumer of natural gas in the United States, Texas being the first, California actually below us.
About two-thirds of the electricity FPL supplies to Floridians is produced by natural gas. Eric Draper is executive director of the conservation group Audubon Florida. He was able to review the plans and evaluate the potential impacts to public lands and wildlife habitat. Draper says FPL took his advice and made a change to avoid harming a tiny federally endangered bird.
They agreed to move the routing on the pipeline to avoid possible impacts to the Florida grasshopper sparrow.
Audubon's preferred energy source is renewable energy, but Draper says this is the next best thing. He likes the fact that if any state lands are affected by the pipelines, FPL has to pay the state 1.5 times what the land is worth.
Natural gas is going to be part of our energy future for a while. It's relatively low cost. Of course, it does have some environmental cost, but we think in that case, you know, given that we're offsetting the environmental impact of building the pipeline, this is an acceptable approach.
The pipes could run through 16 of Florida's 67 counties. FPL is hoping to get approval from the Florida Public Service Commission by the end of the year. I'm Gina Jordan in Tallahassee.
Well, the natural gas that could be pumped through that pipeline would be burned to make electricity. Others want us to put nat gas into our cars and trucks and fueling your car with natural gas instead of gasoline, at least at today's prices. Still, there are only 120,000 vehicles running on natural gas nationwide. But a Fort Lauderdale company is betting that's going to increase. Here's the Miami Herald's Karen Rundlett.
A commercial trucker pulls up at the pump in Pompano Beach. He's filling up at a Wise Gas station. Wise Gas is the name of a Broward company that sells compressed natural gas, CNG for short. CNG is a lot cheaper and cleaner than regular gas. The average price of CNG is a little over $2 a gallon. When was the last time you heard a price like that? Jeff Green is a Wise Gas boss, but he's also a Wise Gas customer. He paid to have his 2008 Ford Escape converted to run on CNG.
It cost me about $4,500.
How much time did it take?
It took about 3 days.
And tell me, how much does it cost you to fill up?
It's a 8-gallon tank, and it cost me about $17.
$17 a tank, compressed natural gas.
That's correct.
That's half what he pays when he's filling up with regular gas.
Show me how it works.
Okay, it's fairly simple. You just disconnect it from the dispenser like this, and then you take this and plug it into the car, and if you hear this click, it tells you that it's connected.
Okay.
And then you turn, you lift.
While we know Green is saving on his gas bill, the question is if he's making money on the CNG business. They've been at it now for 4 years. The answer is yes, the business is profitable and growing by 15 to 20% a quarter, but he says they definitely have a ways to go.
We feel like the margins in natural gas are sufficient to make a good living.
Their most successful market right now is commercial trucks and vans. City Furniture, Cardinal Logistics, and AT&T are some of their biggest clients. But what about the consumer market converting to this green way of gassing up? Regular drivers like you and me.
Well, the industry as a whole has to be further developed for us to get it out to the market. But we feel like regulatory and the industry is kind of catching up with us.
Do you expect to be rich?
I expect to be rich in several years. It's not a get-rich-quick scheme by any means.
If the market catches up to this green product, if there are government incentives perhaps, Jeff Green's success could be golden. For WLRN Miami Herald News, I'm Karen Rundlett for the Sunshine Economy.
Still lots of ifs there. Florida has not offered tax credits to compressed natural gas buyers yet, at least, but a few states like California and Colorado have. Now, in May, the state legislature did approve an incentive to encourage fleet conversion. Businesses that convert their vans and trucks and delivery vehicles to natural gas can get a major rebate. Compressed natural gas, perhaps part of the future of energy here in South Florida. This is the Sunshine Economy. The conversation on Twitter at WLRN. Use the hashtag Sunshine Economy and on the website at WLRN.org. Still to come on the Sunshine Economy, the move to burning natural gas has been motivated partly by price. We've heard that. The fuel is half the price it was just a few years ago. Can it last?
To be honest with you, I don't see too many downsides at this point to have a heavy reliance on natural gas. I can't think of another fuel at this point that makes more sense.
This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. You probably flipped on the light switch this morning. Odds are your air conditioner is running. You didn't give it much thought about where that power is coming from, but for most of us, for some of us, more and more of that power is coming from natural gas. More and more of Florida electricity is being generated by the use of natural gas. This is natural gas that's being imported from other states, not from a foreign source, but from elsewhere in the United States. Some of this expansion that we've seen in the use and reliance of natural gas to produce electricity in South Florida is thanks to the lower price of natural gas. We spoke with Phil Flynn, senior markets analyst and energy trader at the Price Futures Group. He's also a contributor at the Fox Business Network. Phil, thanks for joining us here on the Sunshine Economy. What are the risks of Florida electric utilities shifting their use to natural gas and the demand of natural gas?
You know, if you would have asked me this question, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, I would have said they're crazy. You can't do that. You know, we're running out of natural gas. And, you know, even though the Gulf of Mexico produces, you know, 25% of our supply, you know, you've got to have diversification. You've got to have nuclear. You've got to have coal. But I don't know if it's as crazy as everybody thinks anymore because of the shale gas revolution. I mean, Florida is particularly situated to take advantage of natural gas, unlike a lot of states in other parts of the union.
Now, there is no natural gas underneath Florida, so why is Florida geographically situated to take advantage of this boom in natural gas, especially in the domestic supply, which is where it all comes from inside the United States?
Because what's happening here is that we've got pipelines that are bringing natural gas down from, you know, Oklahoma and to other places. And at the same time, you sit right in the Gulf of Mexico where you have all that offshore production coming in. And, you know, as the infrastructure gets put together for the new pipelines, you're going to be able to take advantage of natural gas, which is a cleaner burning fuel, less risky than nuclear, and a heck of a lot more plentiful than some of the other fuel sources. So from that viewpoint, I think Florida's ripe for this kind of a situation. Now, you do have to build some pipelines and stuff, but once the infrastructure is in place, it makes a lot of sense.
And at least today, natural gas is significantly cheaper than what it was just 5 years ago when it was twice what it is today. The question is, Phil, what's it going to be in another 5 years? Is it going to be the prices we saw back in 2008 or the prices that we're seeing today?
Well, I think it's unlikely we'll get to the all-time highs of above $15, but I do think the prices of natural gas can double and triple. But you know, from Florida's viewpoint, they should take advantage of the glut while they can. And what's nice about this market, Tom, because there is so much supply, you can lock in some very long-term contracts for natural gas at very cheap levels. And I would bet some of those other fuel sources like coal and nuclear could start to go through the roof because of environmental concerns.
All right, that's the price spectrum. What about the supply spectrum in terms of the reliability of that supply? You mentioned the infrastructure that is being built in the state of Florida, but the reliability of the supply of natural gas, especially in the Gulf of Mexico, we've seen can be volatile because we know that we're in storm season here.
We are. And, you know, when we get a tropical storm or a hurricane, production can be shut down. Even though you might see these short-term spikes or supply disruptions due to storms, you know, just as long as you don't rely on, you know, Gulf of Mexico production 100%, the other massive amounts of supply should be able to make up the difference. To be honest with you, I don't see too many downsides at this point to have a heavy reliance on natural gas. I can't think of another fuel at this point that makes more sense.
Doesn't that give you a bit of concern, though, Phil? I mean, you're an energy trader. You feed on volatility. If you don't have any concerns, shouldn't that be a concern for the end user of this electricity, maybe?
Well, I think it is. I mean, listen, we know the one thing that cures low prices is low prices.
Right.
You know, oil prices back in 1999 were $10. They went to $147 a barrel. But if you start putting in the infrastructure and locking in these prices when prices are low, and if you have the foresight to realize that, you know, you need to lock these prices, and if the utilities are smart enough to say, hey, you know what, I'll be happy with these prices for the next 10 to 20, 25 years, if you can knock them, you know, lock these prices in for a quarter of a century, why wouldn't you do it?
Who's competing with Florida for this natural gas?
Well, probably the rest of the world, Tom. You know, we've got countries in Europe, Japan, they're begging us to export our abundant supply of natural gas. They're knocking on the door, begging us. You know, we are in a situation where we're ahead of the rest of the world when it comes to this production, the shale net gas production. Mm-hmm. And if you consider the geopolitical situation, they're putting a lot of pressure on the Obama administration to hurry up and export some of that gas, you know, not only because of the economic advantage it gives our country over theirs, but from a geopolitical risk standpoint. Now, I know that there's companies here in the U.S. that don't want us to export our natural gas. They want to keep it here because it provides cheap gas prices for manufacturing plants, so it creates jobs, and they want to keep that competitive advantage here in the United States.
That's Phil Flynn, a longtime energy trader in Chicago. He's with the Price Futures Group and a contributor to the Fox Business Network. Now, to his point about locking in today's low prices for natural gas to generate electricity in the future, well, we put that question right to the top guy, Eric Szilagyi, president at FPL. Would you like to lock in prices further out than just a year if you could under regulations?
Yeah, I think there would be some interesting opportunities to do it. It's I wouldn't lock in all of our fuel supplies, but to be able to go out and secure supplies when prices are down, I think it's a good thing for customers to provide stability. Like everybody, I like to know when my budget, what it's going to be like, how much I'm going to have to spend at my house. It's the same thing at the utility.
Based upon expected demand, for instance, over the next fiscal year, how much are you able to hedge of that demand that's going to come from FPL?
We're able to go out about 1 year in our supply, and we typically do, Tom, I think it's about 20 or 30% of it, but I'd have to get back to you on the exact amount. You know, it's again, the hedging program, you know, it can go either way, right? Because if you lock in one price and then it actually goes further down, you've now locked in a higher price. If the prices go up, you've locked in a lower price. So I think people have to be careful that assuming that just locking in a price today is always a good thing. We take a very close look at the market every single day. And what you do is you try to figure out what's the best balance. Sometimes it's actually good to be in the spot market because people need to get rid of some gas and they'll sell it at a cheaper amount.
A spot market, of course, is the kind of the cash market, the natural gas that's on the shelf as opposed to the natural gas that's still in the ground.
We basically go out and contract for our gas supplies on a daily, a monthly, semi-annual and annual. So we have different contracts for different lengths of time. And we also have to predict every day how much gas we're going to actually burn, which, of course, is driven by a large extent weather. And so, you know, you only want to lock in a certain amount of gas because it's hard to predict the weather. And Mother Nature can always throw you some curveballs, and it might be cooler, it might be warmer, and you need to have that flexibility to go out and get that gas in order to meet your electric customers' needs.
Still to come here on the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. Stick with us. We'll be talking about the politics of power in Tallahassee.
Everything is paid by consumers. There is the shareholder side of the debate, and there's the ratepayer side of the debate. But in the end, it's the consumers that pay all the bills.
It's the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. The focus by electric utilities on natural gas in the Sunshine State does not mean other sources of power are dead. As we heard early in the program from FPL President Eric Szilagyi, his company continues pushing forward on the possibility of expanding the nuclear plant at Turkey Point. Marilyn Klass is the Capital Bureau Chief for the Miami Herald.
They see that nuclear power right now is something that continues to take a lot of time to develop. And even though natural gas prices are very low and very cost efficient, 20 years from now, maybe things will not look so good. So it's sort of a bird in the hand attitude. As long as the utilities in Florida have the ability to charge consumers for nuclear power that they won't have for another 20 years, I think their feeling is, why not take advantage of it? The legislature made it very easy for them to charge consumers in advance for projects that haven't been built, and so they're moving ahead with that. It makes sense.
Is there anything going on in Tallahassee that is either encouraging or discouraging this continued look at atomic energy as a way to diversify our energy portfolio here in the Sunshine State?
A few years ago, this was a really important issue. Back in 2006, there was a push to encourage more renewable energy. The greenhouse gas emission debate was going on intensively. And so the legislature decided that it was going to try and encourage these alternative energy sources. And that in at the same time they were doing that, the power companies said, well, one low emissions alternative is nuclear power. So they used that momentum to get this legislation passed. Since then, all the push for alternative energy, solar energy incentives, all those other programs have fallen by the wayside. But the utility industry has succeeded in keeping alive this this law that basically says that utility companies can charge in advance for their preparation to build a nuclear power plant. And I don't see that changing. This year was the first time they had an opportunity to repeal it. I mean, they've had attempts to repeal it year after year, but those bills never even got a hearing. This year they finally got a bill. There was momentum to repeal the legislation, but there was such a pushback from FPL that they decided that they weren't going to repeal the law. They were just going to tweak it some and make it a little bit more restrictive.
We heard from FPL's management earlier in the program that the justification is charging for the regulations to get over the hurdle in order to build the plant, that once the plant is actually going to be under construction, that's money, that's capital that the company puts at risk, not through consumers.
Well, it's true, but you got to remember that this is a company that is a monopoly, and everything is paid by consumers. So there is the shareholder side of the debate, and there's the ratepayer side of the debate. But in the end, it's the consumers that pay all the bills. While their argument is that their advance expenses should be paid for by customers, so that they can, as they said, get over the hurdle. In the past, this has been something that has been paid for by shareholders and then reimbursed by customers. They make the argument, however, that the cost of capital is so expensive that this is really a much more efficient way to do it. I think regulators see that argument, and they have agreed. The question kind of still out there is, do we need nuclear plants? And what will it look like in 20 years? Will natural gas still be low in cost? Will there be even other alternatives that may not make it so feasible to be using nuclear power? That's not a question that anybody is able to answer, and it's not one that FPL even is required to answer.
One question that's out there is political influence in the power industry. 90% of that industry, at least in the Sunshine State, is the electric generation industry. But as that industry looks more toward natural gas to fuel electric generation, are we seeing more natural gas interests being represented in Tallahassee?
You know, that's a good question. I think that the utility companies are the ones that are the biggest lobbying group. The natural gas industry is not so much separate from them. It's their bottom line that uses natural gas, and so it's their teams of lobbyists that are influential up here. And the utility companies in Florida are probably one of the biggest and most active campaign contributors to the political process. They always have been.
And finally, within electric utilities, we have seen some mergers happen outside of Southeast Florida, most notably Duke Energy and Progress Energy. How are those greeted in Tallahassee on the part of regulators and legislators?
I think that regulators took a good look at it, and they obviously approved the merger between Progress and Duke. There is a little sentiment that because Duke is based in North Carolina, it's no longer a Florida-grown operation, that there is probably a little less empathy for them because of that. But they have a pretty active presence here in the state. They hired a lot of the same people that Progress had, and I think they're still viewed similarly as they were back when they were Progress Energy and owned solely in Florida.
Mary Ellen Klass, Capital Bureau Chief in Tallahassee for the Miami Herald. Still to come on the Sunshine Economy, from nat gas to gasoline. Is our South Florida car culture ready for electric cars?
I've had it 2.5 years, and I've never been in a gas station in that time.
This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN, Power in Paradise, the energy industry in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Thank you for listening. Well, you probably will do this a few times today. That's the sound of my car starting up, the jingling of the keys, pushing a button, sending a spark to the engine, setting off controlled explosions of gasoline, and then that low rumble of an internal combustion engine in idle. But Linda Gassenheimer hears this. That's it. No spark, no mix of gasoline and oxygen, no controlled explosions, and certainly no rumble. Just three clicks and her electric car is running. All right, go ahead and start it up. I'm not sure where to put the microphone here, Linda. There's no engine to put the microphone toward. All right, let me...
See how quiet it is?
Let me get in here. And we'll go for a ride in Linda's blue car.
And let's put your seatbelt on.
So you're sure the motor is actually running? I don't hear a thing.
No.
There's no rumble. There's no vibration. And we should say it's a relatively small car. It's a two-seater with a hatchback in the back.
Imagine getting into your car every day, going to work, and not having to worry about the cost of your gas mileage. Now, I'm going to put the air conditioner on, and that does make a little bit of noise.
All right, well, it is a hot day, and it's kind of sprinkling here as we're pulling out of the parking lot.
And what surprised me when you first got into my car, Tom, is that you said, does it have airbags? Sure, it has all the safety features you want in any car that has to be sold in America.
So give us an idea of what you look at while you're
driving the car? What's on the dashboard? Those kind of indicators that everybody's so familiar with driving a gasoline car.
Okay. There's the normal, you know, speedometer. And by the way, people ask me, you know, how does it work? This car is so zippy. I just love it. It zips along. It goes from 0 to 30 in seconds. I have to be careful. I'm over the speed limit before I know. Can I keep up with the other cars? I can pass the other cars. Also, it has a gauge that says 0 to 100%. And that tells me how much percentage of the electricity I have left.
Okay.
Have I run out? No. I've had it 2.5 years, and I've never been in a gas station in that time.
Talk to us about how you had to get your home ready to accept an all-electric car. Because is it as simple as just getting a drop cord out into the garage?
You can do anything. This car, I carry around with me, actually, a 110 plug. I can plug in any 110 anywhere. I happen to also put an extra long extension cord in case I need to knock on your door. I have not had to do that. So you can plug it into 110. I plug it into 240. All houses have 240. I had a 240 charging station put in my garage.
What kind of cost did that set you back?
Yes. Now, that was expensive, I will say. It was about between $2,000 and $3,000, but that's because I decided to have a separate line put in.
So that was an initial investment that obviously anybody buying a gasoline-powered car wouldn't have. What about the cost of the car itself to purchase?
This car was about $28,000, but I have an HD radio. You don't have to add that in, but I added in my HD radio.
Well, you do work in radio, so that makes sense.
Exactly. Yeah. But I got a $7,500 tax deduction on my income tax. So you do the math.
So that brought the cost down to roughly $22,000. Plus, we'll call the $3,000 to get your garage set up to plug it in. So
right. All
in about $25,000. Given the fact that you haven't visited a gas station in the last 2 years,
two and a half years,
gasoline prices have been averaging $3.50, $3.75 a gallon, when do you think you'll have this car essentially paid for in the savings of gasoline?
You do the math. I don't know. But here, let's face it. If you're going to buy a car, you're going to spend money on a car.
Yeah. Well, I did do the math, Linda, and she said she has about 12,500 miles in the car. It's a small car, so figure about 25 miles to the gallon. That would mean she would have burned 500 gallons of gasoline if her car ran on gasoline. So next, I called GasBuddy.com to find out the average price of a gallon of regular unleaded gas over the past 2.5 years that Linda has owned her electric car. In Miami, it ranged from $2.70 a gallon back in 2010. It ran up to almost $4 a gallon last year. And the average was $3.52 a gallon over the past 2.5 years. So, by not having to buy gas, Linda has saved $1,760. Of course, that does not count the electricity that she does have to buy now, but she also told us that she hasn't noticed a difference in her electric bill since buying the car. But the rest of us have to fill her up, sometimes often. We visit a gas station maybe every few days, maybe once a week. I pulled into Doucette Mobile last week on Southwest 104th and US 1. All right, time to fill it up here. Got to put the credit card in the machine and go through the security measures here. 5-digit zip code. Select my grade. I've got to go with the super here, which is $4.26 a gallon. High octane stuff. And we'll watch the numbers climb. Well, while I was at the station, I spoke with owner Lee Doucette. His dad started the business in 1961, and he's been running it for the past 5 years.
Demand's down a little. It is down a little, but I do see more efficient fuel burning cars, more and more of them.
Yeah.
More of the hybrids. Newer cars that are getting better mileage. People are getting smaller cars. They're not in the big boats, the four-door old that weigh, you know, 2 tons and draw a lot of gas. But everybody's downsizing, no matter who it is. It could be a guy who could afford the fuel, but he's still going to downsize and get a car that is getting better mileage.
All right, so demand may be down a little bit thanks to the recent jump in prices. When the price in the corner sign approaches $4 a gallon, Doucette tells me the drivers do change their habits.
If it goes over the four mark, we see a downward decline in demand. The people stop using the cars. People will stop going places. They'll become very wise on how they burn their fuel. In my lifetime, being just over 50 years old, will I see gasoline disappear? I don't think so. I don't know if we'll ever see gasoline disappear, but I think we will see it used differently.
Do you think at any point you're going to put in an electric refueling station here at 104th and Dixie?
It's gone through my head. It's gone through my head to buy one just so I can work on them. I can look at them and I have the concept of what's happening.
You've seen prices in your career go from cents on the gallon to close to $4. You've even put a five up on the board back maybe 12, 13, 14 months ago. Do you see prices peeling back to, say, $2.50 a gallon, anything around that area?
I don't think we'll ever see the $2.50 again. We'll see the threes, the lower threes, I think, during certain times. But as to say that we're going to go into the twos, it's hard to say. Too many things have to happen. Everything in the Middle East has to go perfectly right. We have to have a barrel that people want to pump it out of the ground, and we have a huge supply. And then we have to have all of our refineries working at a pace of we need to work them harder because they're not working as hard. We have an overabundance of refineries, which we don't have, which we're short in refineries. So if all the pieces of the puzzle got put back together, we could see a $2 gallon again, but to say that it's going to happen, I don't see that happening.
We're cracking over 11 gallons now, and we've just passed the $50 mark on this fill-up. Should be getting close to topping it off, I hope. You know, the gas pumps these days are entertainment kiosks too, and it's kind of interesting as I'm filling up my car with gasoline at $4.26 a gallon. One of the advertisements that's playing here is for the Chevy Volt, which of course is a combination electric and hybrid that sports a pretty good miles per gallon fuel efficiency on it. $60 on the nose. Just over 14 gallons of gas. And that will take me, depending on how much traffic I encounter, hopefully just over 320 miles. And I'm still running on that specific tank of gas, even as prices have come down here in South Florida. It is the Sunshine Economy here on WLRN, powering paradise energy in South Florida. You'll find more online at WLRN.org, including a video of FPL tearing down a 60-year-old electric generating plant in South Dade County as it makes way for a new generation of power plants, those to be included that run on natural gas. It's powering paradise, the energy industry right here in South Florida on the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. And tweet us at WLRN, use the hashtag Sunshine Economy. Now, the energy certainly is about supply and demand economics. At its base, that's what it's all about. A supply of reliable and relatively cheap energy has to be out there for all of us in South Florida and for all the nation in order for prosperity. You have to, though, balance that relatively cheap energy with demand for safe and secure power, allowing the economy to hit that accelerator. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.